Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown, and today I'll be talking with Andrew Lewis, who is the author of The Right's Turn in Conservative Christian Politics, How Abortion Transformed the Culture Wars. The book is published by Cambridge University Press this year, and I have the pleasure to talk with Andrew Lewis today. Andy, how are you doing?
I'm great, Heath. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing really well and enjoyed reading your book. We
talked
previously about how this book fits with a couple of other recent books that we've had on. So I hope that people who listen regularly to the podcast, this is serving as kind of a mini conference on a related subject matter. Before we get to the subject matter and your interesting book, why don't you just share a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Well, I've been at the University of Cincinnati since 2012. I have a PhD in political science and law and society from American University. And after that, I did a year of a postdoc at Princeton University. And I also have a master's degree in ethics, in Christian ethics, and so interest in theology prior to that. And so this book sort of comes out of, builds out of my interest in religion and politics and law are all sort of entwined in this book. And so this is sort of builds on those things. But my research area and my research interests are sort of at the intersection of law and politics and religion in America. And I approach that from sort of a mixture of quantitative and qualitative and historical studies. And so this is where we are. And I'm really sort of excited that it's released.
Yeah, and the book is just out, just now available, very recently. And
yeah, we shipped you. Yours may have been warm still when it went in the mail.
It felt that way, and I read it so quickly that it stayed warm.
Because it's one of those Domino's pizza bags to keep.
That's right.
Warm, I think.
No steam. So there's a lot of stuff in your book, but terminology I think is important.
Sure.
To this, and in your book, you focus on white evangelicals. So why white evangelicals and not all evangelicals, and why evangelicals and not all Protestants living in the United States? I wonder if you could explain a little bit about the specific people you focus on here.
Yeah, I know. I think that's a good question. Pretty good insight. I mean, in part, white evangelicals are sort of the cultural class that most people I think are interested in. When you think about deep cultural concerns, right? Cultural divisions, culture war topics is often sort of this white evangelical divide in America versus a divide of sort of either classically a mainline Protestant divide, which we would call maybe a moderate liberal Protestant divide, or even an African American Protestant divide. So we separate out often in the study of religion these different religious traditions. And so, in order to be sensitive to the different sort of historical and racial differences, there's often sort of a limitation to sort of the white evangelical history, and so. Here I sort of classically focus on that, primarily on that subgroup. You know, there's some attention to Catholics and sort of the conservative Christian tradition, and that Catholics would come alongside that. There's very little attention to sort of African-American traditions. Evangelicals in general, sort of non-African-American evangelicals, those churches are becoming a little more diverse, adding sort of Hispanics and Asians and other groups alongside. And so, you know, it is important to understand that. But I also think that there is sort of this sort of classic white evangelical heritage and culture that is also really important to sort of to understand it as well. So there are these big groups that they represent the sort of growing diversity, but also they are sort of classically racially sort of white. So I don't know. I don't spend a ton of time sort of dwelling on sort of the racial aspects, but particularly in survey data, they're often sort of categorized out in sort of these racial categories. And there's a whole debate about what's the best way to do that. And this is often the way that survey researchers have gone. And so I sort of follow their lead.
Right. Now, your title of the book plays on the double meaning of right, the political meaning and the legal constitutional meaning.
Sure.
What does it mean to take a turn towards rights? Rights as opposed to what other way of viewing public policies and politics?
Yeah. So one of the big themes of the book is sort of the shift from the moral politics, particularly, and framing issues in the politics of morality. And you can think of things like the moral majority of the late 70s and 1980s that was predominant in conservative Christian politics. And now it's much more focused on the idea of rights and this sort of, you can even think of it as this threatened minority politics. And so this vision of, rather than pursuing this majority strategy focused on morals and sort of protecting this the proper morals of the country, it's about defending the particular rights of a Christian minority. And so this turn toward rights, this turn towards certain individual Christian rights, individual liberalism, that's the evolution, that's the turn and the shift from sort of morality politics to sort of certain type of rights politics.
Now, recently on the podcast, we heard from Chris Baylor and his book on the role of the religious right in transforming the Republican Party.
Yeah.
Your focus here is not so much on partisan politics, but on attitudes towards public policy.
Right.
But you also trace a political history in your book.
Right.
And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about where your history begins and what was happening in conservative, if it was even conservative, but in Christian politics at the start of the story that you tell.
Sure. In different issues, I perhaps start in different places, but I begin mostly in the middle of the 20th century. And in the middle of the 20th century, you have primarily conservative Christians, particularly evangelical Christians, who are oriented toward, common good, public policy, keeping the peace, morality. They are, this is part of, this is part of sort of the silent majority. They become part of the moral majority movements, right? And there's a slow uptake into the movement of what is now known as the pro-life movement, particularly on the evangelical side. And this starts with sort of Catholic and even some more liberal Protestants, and then there's a slow uptake into evangelicals. But this is where I sort of trace this foundation is sort of what you might think of as civic republicanism, communitarian sort of public policy movements, and they're in sort of the in and they get filtered into sort of Republican Party movements, and then by the second wave, particularly in the 1990s to the present, they become much more interested in ideas of rights and free speech and religious freedom, and I trace that a lot to sort of declining cultural power of Christianity, particularly conservative Christianity, sort of cultural threats that they're facing. But a lot of it, I give a lot of attention to sort of the learning about the power of rights and the importance of rights that happened through the pro-life movement. So the combination of declining cultural power, learning about rights from the pro-life movement, sort of training conservative Christians to think about rights.
Yeah, and so your book is also about transformation, but a transformation towards at least one policy and more as you get into the book, specifically the issue of abortion.
Right.
And you focus very much on many of the elite actors and the kind of education, training, and that you just allude to. So who are these important players in this transformation? Which groups feature prominently in the shifting policy views of evangelicals and are instigating a change and move in direction towards a rights-based ideology?
Yeah, I think you know, I think there are a handful of people that I'm not sure that there are any sort of one particular group. I don't, or one particular person. You know, I think this is something that evolves over time, and it's sort of I sort of try to show like this big episode, and that happens sort of over decades. You know, someone like there's a theologian and activist. His name is Francis Schaeffer, who starts to bring some of this Catholic rights to life language that came out of sort of the Catholic pro-life tradition. He starts to bring some of that into evangelicalism, though he also wedded that with sort of this cultural morality. And early on, the evangelicals who were taking up Francis Schaeffer's language often used more of his cultural morality language, the moral failings, more than his sort of human rights emphasis. And so that took off more. But there was this thread of human rights and right to life language that continued on in sort of the pro-life movement. And by the end of the 80s, it seemed to be that more of the rights-based language in the pro-life movement seemed to win out. And so groups like the National Association of Evangelicals and even the Southern Baptists by the middle of the 1990s seemed to move much more toward rights when they talked about anti-abortion politics than in talking about it in terms of morality. They talked about it more in rights and justice language. And so there are a handful of Southern Baptist leaders who would push these issues. Christianity Today, sort of the big evangelical publication, moved in this direction. So there are a handful of sort of big tent evangelical leaders and magazines that would do this. Ralph Reed, who led big evangelical organizations, tried to move evangelicals toward having a more of a professionalized strategy and a more of a public way to argue issues. And that public way to argue issues would mean we would use less sort of Bible terms and less morality and argue it more on in ways that we could have more public debates. And that often means including language that the public could be more accessible to. And that is sort of like rights and more political language, right? And less religious type language. And so there were a variety of people who were making these streams of arguments. And so over time, it seems that this stuff sort of filters into the culture. So I'm not certain that there was one exact person, but there are a handful of people that brought and filtered these messages, and they sort of and so I trace like a handful of these streams and show that like over basically 15 years, they find their way as sort of the dominant way that these messages get reframed.
Yeah, and the book is not just about changing views towards abortion and
right.
It's also about the links between excuse me, those views and other views. And you focus in chapter 5 on evangelical views towards healthcare.
Right.
Would you trace where opinions had been on government-provided healthcare programs and where they are more recently? Because this is one of the really interesting transformations and changes that happen over time.
Yeah, so the argument that I tried to plot about the role of abortion in evangelical politics, and maybe perhaps I should just back up, is sort of twofold. And it's that abortion is so central for evangelical politics for two reasons. One is that it sort of represents evangelicals in enormous ways, because it's the issue that it's so important to the movement. And so evangelical advocacy leaders will use the issue of abortion and as sort of a springboard to advocate on all kinds of other issues. So there may be issues that the base of the mass either they're not certain on, they don't have a clear advocacy position on, or even they might disagree with the elite leaders on. But if the leadership can tie it to abortion, then it gives them some leverage, some leeway. And so it's sort of there's a way that they can extend the sphere of their advocacy by linking it to abortion. And then abortion also sort of has seems to have been able to teach evangelicals about the value of public rights arguments in other spheres. So it sort of both teaches about rights and also represents in other issues. So in healthcare, evangelicals for decades essentially mirror the national population when it comes to national healthcare, meaning they are sort of moderate in what they think about national healthcare. But when it comes to national healthcare initiatives, they have been strongly opposed to some of the major national healthcare initiatives. And so the question is, how have mass evangelical movements been so opposed to these national healthcare initiatives? And I tend to think that like we have overlooked the role of abortion in helping mobilize evangelicals against many of these major healthcare initiatives. A lot of that is linked back to questions that like the Hyde Amendment started to try to deal with, like who is going to pay for abortions when abortion becomes a fundamental right. And these questions of abortion and healthcare get sort of forever linked once Roe becomes a fundamental right. And this is always a question about healthcare politics. And this is the way that evangelical advocates are always trying to mobilize the base about abortion and healthcare. When going back to the Clinton health plan and to the Affordable Care Act and to the present, like these are the key messaging strategies, and it seems to be fairly effective.
You also link views towards abortion to views on the death penalty. And in order to do this, you conducted an experiment to tease out the causal relationships between religion and opinion. I wonder if you could explain a little bit about how you designed the experiment and also what you discovered.
Yeah, great. One of the really interesting relationships about abortion and capital punishment, and one of the real critiques about abortion and capital punishment is that evangelicals, for example, people will say that they're not consistent on the death penalty and the fact that, you know, they will support killing people convicted of murder, but they won't support abortion. And so what's the scoop on that? You know, they're not consistent on those issues. I wanted to sort of look into that. Well, Catholics, for example, they have a bit of a different view, and this view has particularly become important in the last 30 or 40 years. Pope John Paul really started pushing this idea of this seamless garment of life approach, where you would sort of be pro-life for unborn children and also be sort of pro-life and oppose the death penalty. And in fact, Pope Francis has even sort of taken this one step further in the last month or so. But evangelicals, I sort of looked into it, and the evangelical theology seems to be that rather than focusing on the accused or those convicted of murder, their real attention on sort of the sanctity of life seems to be on the victims. And so you'll see a lot of theological defenses of saying something like, well, the reason that we need to support capital punishment is we value life so much that taking innocent life is so bad that the innocent life is of such a high value that the only proper punishment is the only retribution is sort of taking a life, right? That's the only proper punishment. And so this made me think like, okay, well, are these sort of frames out there? Like, does this even matter to anyone? Like, are people convinced by any of these arguments? And so what I did is I created a framing experiment, and I put a few different options. And there are a few different options out there in the public today. Classically, there's sort of these justice frames that we should oppose the death penalty because there are innocent people perhaps on death row. And this is sort of framing a classic book by Frank Baumgartner and his colleagues out a few years ago. One is we should oppose death penalty because the costs and benefits the costs are too high. And then, you know, I put some arguments about why we should support the death penalty, right? That, that it would be unjust, you know, not to, not to, uh, not to have proper punishments for someone just convicted of murder. And so I had a handful of arguments for and against the death penalty, including these pro-life arguments. And what essentially we come up with is that the pro-life arguments opposing the death penalty are not very effective at all. And in fact, you get a little bit of sort of backlash from liberals and Democrats who seem to say, like, this is we would rather just we don't like these religious arguments opposing the death penalty. We'd rather just go with these justice arguments or even these cost and benefit arguments. Okay, the best arguments for opposing the death penalty, even for Christians, are sort of that innocent people will be on death row or that it costs too much. But it does seem that you know, the pro-life arguments for the death penalty are a little persuasive for Christians, particularly, that they sort of buy this retribution argument. And so all that it goes to say is that these counter-arguments, when they're made, may have some sort of, promote some sort of stasis among evangelicals, that it allows, it keeps them from sort of moving toward abolition, perhaps. There's a lot of movement opposing the death penalty these days, and even some big religious groups are moving to oppose. But this sort of argument about that we should protect victims seems to be fairly potent. And if they tie it to abortion issues, perhaps that might be effective on at least mitigating the opposition to the capital punishment. We'll see. I think there's a lot of cultural movement opposing the death penalty. So, but I'm not sure that sort of the Catholic pro-life movement is the way to go if you're looking to oppose capital punishment. I think that's the takeaway.
Yeah, and towards the end of the book, you start to you move a little bit into a discussion of what's going on today and also in the future. And in the epilogue of the book, in particular, you connect this historical transformation to the election of Donald Trump.
Right.
What does the future hold for a political movement that appears, at least, to be at odds with much of what we see from President Trump? And so put us in today and also maybe focus on what we might expect in the future.
Yeah, I think this is I had to write the epilogue in some sense because I finished the manuscript a couple months before the election. And then that was the question, like, what does the election hold for this movement? As I think it, I see in many parts of the evangelical movement progressing toward rights, toward components of liberalism, toward components of valuing sort of individual rights for themselves, and even respecting the rights of others, in grand shifts, though that's sort of episodic in many ways. But, you know, if you zoom out, you see much more sort of respecting and tolerating the rights of others among evangelicals than you have had in the last several decades. And so I think those are really grand takeaways. But, like, what do you do with, you know, the election of 2016 and where we're going? And I think what you have is sort of a real question among evangelicals, a real division on, like, what's the way forward. It seems like we have a handful of camps, what to do. And, you know, one camp, I think, is trying to reclaim sort of this prior generation, or you know, this sort of prior Christian America generation, this generation where they were sort of this cultural majority, this past moral majority kind of thing, and a different camp seems to recognize that they are, like, the reality that they are in this more of a moral minority, right? And the reality is that they need to sort of protect their rights. They need to move toward sort of trying to operate in a pluralistic environment. That means protecting their rights and perhaps making allies with other people and protecting other people's rights in order to get their own rights protected, right? Making allies and those kind of things. The problem is that might have meant voting for the same presidential candidate for many of those same people in the same camps. Like, I think many of them thought that they voted for the same candidate, but for slightly different reasons. But there is sort of a division on what the best strategy is going forward. Like, what are they after? And so I do think that there are underneath the surface of who they voted for in November are real sort of tense differences on sort of where evangelicals think they are going and they should go, what kind of strategies they should pursue. And we see these battles waged over things like how they should protect religious freedom and should religious freedom be protected only for Christians, or should religious freedom be more of an inclusive right? And so you get a lot of big mainstream evangelical groups arguing for a broader inclusive right to religious freedom, and particularly younger evangelicals pushing those. And you get more particularly older, more politically Republican-oriented groups, different era religious leaders really wanting to have religious freedom be much more of a narrow right and really concerned about things like Muslim threats and those kind of things. So these are where we find these real divisions.
Yeah, the book, again, is titled The Right's Turn in Conservative Christian Politics, How Abortion Transformed the Culture Wars. The author who you've been listening to is Andrew Lewis. The publisher, again, is Cambridge University Press. Andy, thank you very much for your time today.
No, thank you, Heath. I really enjoyed it. It was fun.